Get ready to learn about adapting to climate change, protecting your own food health, southern living, and the struggle for justice. This is Radio EcoShock. When the African American Heritage Seed Collection was begun, organizers turned to culinary historian Michael W. Twitty. Michael has just returned from a tour of the former slave states in the American South. He was seeking his roots and cooking them. Michael recently met up with Radio EcoShock Washington correspondent Jerry Williams. As a research associate at the College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability, and Environmental Science at the University of D.C., Jerry is tuned into African American culture, food production, and our environment. I'm betting you don't know about slave gardens or the two foods that may move from the bird feeder to your dinner plate as climate change develops. Jerry begins by asking Michael Twitty about his well-named Southern Discomfort Tour.
Now, you found out firsthand how farmers, family farmers, are on the front lines of the climate change and food production when you undertook what you've called your Southern Discomfort Tour. I love that. I love that term. Tell me about that. What was it that motivated you to really go to small farms, to work on the farms, to find out about that way of life? And what did you learn along the way?
Well, I learned first and foremost that African American farmers are in a bad way. We deserve, as a people, we deserve our rural reparations. Even now, we're struggling. Our community needs to have access to food within the confines that we're allowed. But the bottom line is, there are so many people doing everything they can to change the tide, and that's really encouraging.
Now, how did you decide on the route you would take and the farms that you visited and the farms you worked on, as a matter of fact, too? You did some hard labor.
A little bit. It pretty much got confined to North Carolina to Louisiana, with some stops in Virginia and Maryland. But in the Lowcountry as well, we have to handle that. But because of some issues with presentations and timing, we had to change the route, which would have pretty much gone through every slaveholding state. We didn't have time for that. But it really came down to word of mouth and people saying, okay, you have to go here. You have to go there to visit this person. I met the great-granddaughter of Kudjoe Lewis, who was the last man of African descent, human of African descent, brought this country on a slave ship from Africa as late as 1860. So if you can imagine, his great-great-granddaughter is my age about, and her great-great-grandfather was the last person brought in a slave ship to the South. You know, what were they eating? What were they doing? That's what we're lacking. I mean, I can't say this enough. I did this tour simply because I realized that there was a world that was dying, a world that was being born, and a world that we needed to sustain. A culture, a culinary tradition, seeing places of liberation, of examples of things we should be doing today. I mean, I learned at the River Road Museum in Louisiana, in Donaldsonville, that there were African-American cooperative farms and what they call, I wouldn't say poor folks farm, but they were owned by, in common by the community, and food was being grown there for the sake of people who were sharecropping or tenant farmers who were poor. And they could just come and get food. And they didn't have to beg anybody for it. It was from their community to their community and back. And just thinking about that, 100 years ago we were doing this. Why can't we do that now with better resources?
Michael, tell me about what you think are some of the challenges that you found with these small farming communities that you visited. What are farmers telling you about how they're coping with weather challenges?
This year was particularly hard. In terms, you know, growing corn. I mean, corn is the mainstay of most eastern farms, most southern farms. And corn was withering. I mean, it was still a great shock to me to see field after field after field in every state, dry as a bone, burned to a crisp. It was devastating. It was, you know, like losing a family member almost. That's a big part of our culinary culture, a big part of our folk culture. And just seeing people struggle with that, not having a corn crop to feed their animals, to feed themselves, to sell on the road, you know, green corn, roasting ears, what they used to call them, was really hard. But I mean, it's our heritage that will save us. You know, sorghum and millet, which are from Africa are drought-resistant or drought-tolerant crops. We already have the seeds of our heritage to save us. And we need to switch to some of those. We need to start utilizing some of them. We need to put them in our diet. You know, I shudder to think that most Americans know sorghum and millet from bird food. That's human food. That ain't bird food. They don't grow a crop that's called bird food. It's really human food. Maybe we should learn to eat those things again and use them again to save ourselves. That is a definite big issue. Access to clean water, environmental justice is really important. And unfortunately for us, a lot of our lands and our farms were always located in the bottoms. And I don't mean the bottom lands either. And we had to deal with that. And those are the same places that are facing massive problems with pollution, acid rain, drought, and other things today. So we have a lot of challenges, but I think we can meet them just because, you know, there are still black farmers driving from Arkansas, Missouri, Tennessee, Mississippi to Chicago. There are still black farmers coming up from Carolina to D.C. and Baltimore and to New York with fresh collard greens and sweet potatoes with Reverend Sampson likes to say, leave the dirt on them. I want people to see where this comes from. Don't make them clean and pretty. Leave the dirt on them. Make them wash the dirt off of home. You know, keep those vitamins and those nutrients in that potato as long as possible because we need every one of them.
Tell me about what you've learned in your research regarding the food and food culture of African Americans.
Well, I think one of the things that really sets me apart is that I did not want to be an armchair culinary historian. I got involved locally doing living history, and that was really important to my education because, you know, it's one thing for someone to say this is how they did things. It's another thing to actually learn how they did it by trial and error, and that's a very important part of this, trial and error. You cannot, if you make something perfect the first time on an open hearth, you're lucky. You're not skilled, you're lucky. It takes, you know, burning a lot of arm hair off, losing eyebrows, smelling like bacon for days. And I don't mean because you use bacon, because you smell like the combination of wood smoke and flesh. There's a lot of hard work to this, you know. It's really a process. And it's a process that not a lot of people are willing to go through to learn about this. People learn it about a lot of things from a distance. They learn vicariously. And for me, vicarious experiences are not pleasurable. I have to experience things for myself. One thing that I've learned the most is a profound respect for the patience, endurance, and flexibility of people of the past, especially people of color. You know, if a sweet potato was 3/4 okay and 1/4 burned, you found a way to make that 100% of it work. And it takes skill to do the simplest things. I mean, roasting a sweet potato in ashes is not simple. It's much easier to throw it in the microwave or boil it, but roasting it is a whole different story. I've learned how to butcher animals. I've learned how to grow heirloom crops, different types, and I've seen them get eaten up by bugs or the weather takes them out, or a branch, and wept over them. And all of that is part of the experience. And you have to remember and learn that back then, if that happened to you, you couldn't just run to a supermarket to recoup your losses. You had to deal with that reality. So I think one of the best parts of being a culinary historian who practices what he preaches, or at least gets into the field, literally, and experiences all of this, is that you learn to be humble and learn to be respectful of the ancestors within seconds of your arrival in the field.
Now, you were invited a few years ago to curate the catalog of the Landreth Seed Company, in which you selected and annotated what was called the African American Heritage Collection. Tell me about that experience.
There wasn't really ever before a collection that focused on African-American heirlooms. And it was really just, you know, what they had in stock and what they could acquire. And it really felt as though we were doing something that was not just novel, but important. A lot of people will give you attitude or question your motives or be suspicious of any time you label something African-American. Why do you have to be different? Why do you have to do that? Isn't it all just the same? And I'm sorry, it's not. It's not. We can all have a tomato in front of us. What we do with that tomato, that's our ethnicity. There's nothing wrong with, you know, being universal. I'm all for that. But there's also a thing called ownership. And, you know, it's everything from the fish pepper, which I've championed, to different kinds of eggplants and collard greens and potatoes and sweet potatoes and heirloom tomatoes and just things we think of in terms of the African-American contribution to the American diet, which was largely plant food. I mean, everybody, you know, thinks of it as being fried food and protein. It was really mostly plant food. And it also speaks to the idea of where do we center the plate? Is the plate centered in the entree and what goes with it? Or is the plate centered in terms of the things that come out of the earth, things that teach you the art of patience and delayed gratification? I am not a vegetarian. But I will say that growing my own food and growing my own vegetables, especially these heirlooms, has taught me not just respect for the past, that would be almost cliche to say, but it also has taught me the difference between meat eating and relying on vegetables and grains. With vegetables and grains, you learn the wisdom of patience and delayed gratification. With meat eating, you learn the immediacy of murder and death. Slaughter. So you have to kind of balance those two elements out. There's a time for everything, as Ecclesiastes says, but mostly there's time for developing a sense of gratitude and desire for those things that are the most enduring.
Now, speaking of seeds, you do mention seeds frequently in your writing and your presentations. Tell me about the importance of seed varieties from the past and what we're dealing with today in terms of the viability of the seeds to feed us here and in the world.
At the current time, I'm working with Reverend Al Sampson out of Chicago, who was one of the few people ordained by Dr. King. Tells me stories all the time about what it was like to spend the night in jail in Georgia and Alabama, other parts of the South. He's developing a seed bank for Black America, and I'm advising him on that. And we're just encouraging, you know, especially urban communities, to understand where their food supply comes from, to grow their own food, and to really not rely on genetically modified seeds and other food sources. To realize that, you know, Monsanto and other companies, the big money companies, they're not really acting in our best interest, especially the interest of those who are poor or people of color. That's not justice. You know, we've talked a lot about food justice and social justice and environmental justice, and they're all connected. You can't extract one from the other. And it's also a fantastic way for us to bridge and unify and work with others. This is not a, you know, an effort that's limited by your phenotype at all. Every human being has to eat. And so if there was anything that we should unify together and work together on, it would be the issue of where our food comes from and the viability and sustainability of food sources. That will determine our future, and not our future in 100 years, our future in 10, 20, 50 years, drastically. I will say this. Tom Buford, who is a savant, an erudite gentleman farmer from Virginia, taught me something very valuable. He said, it's important to have more than one kind of apple, if only because when apples change, when the climate changes, you need to have the right kind of apple available. He said, apples are a cold weather fruit. Really, they're a fruit that has to have the chill. But he said, Southern heritage apples are apples that are used to warmer climates. He said, we're going to have to rely on those apples more and more as the climate changes. You will have to rely on certain types of rice, certain types of potato. I mean, we don't even think about, you know, those foods that require a lot of moisture, those foods that require heavy insect pollination, those foods that require cool weather or cool climates. Those crops are in danger of being not so much lost, but being phased out or being unsustainable because their climate is changing. And so knowing, you know, multiple varieties of things is extremely crucial to our long-term survival. That's why we can't afford to throw away things. We can't afford to rely on monoculture. We cannot afford to rely on two or three varieties of things. It's not an issue of taste. It's an issue of basic environmental principle. When the environment changes, you better change with it or you will become extinct.
Before our listeners that don't know about it, could you elaborate a little bit on what it is the big seed companies and the agribusiness companies like Monsanto are actually doing to our food supply, particularly with seeds?
Well, it comes down to this. There are massive farms that are producing most of the food. It's not family farms. Family farms are struggling. Family farms are struggling to keep up. They're also struggling to keep up legally because, you know, hey, if Monsanto gives industrial farm seed and their pollen from that crop gets into your crop, Monsanto has actually sued people for violation of their patent based on just having crops next to their GMO crops. And that's really, it's not just unfair, it's unethical. And plus you're getting their chemicals and their genetic changes in food, whether you like it or not. So this idea that they're saving the world from starvation is nonsense. But it also comes down to this. If in your market there are only certain types of plant foods available, like a certain type of tomato or potato or whatever. By the way, that's what started the potato famine, when you only had one type of potato and was replicated over and over and over again. And when that one type of potato got sick, all the potatoes got sick, and we lost the food supply.
You're talking about the potato famine
in Ireland, in the 1800s, in the mid-1800s.
Which millions of people perished.
Millions of people. It changed the history of the entire Western world, not to mention Ireland. Ireland's a very small country, but you have to think about it this way. We weren't really going to settle the West, but then we got this huge influx of people from Europe coming over because of wars and famines. Our entire economic, ethnic, social history was changed based on an unreliable and unsustainable food supply. But right now, Monsanto is actually losing their own battle because their chemicals and their genetic engineering is not smarter than nature. As of a couple of days ago, I was reading about how so-called insect-resistant crops are not insect-resistant. Nature doesn't play that. You know, nature has to feed itself. Nature will always win. It was built to last, and we weren't. So they're finding out that their, you know, crops that they've touted and lobbied for and have out-purchased others on are not working. And that should tell us something, that the product they have to offer is not our savior. In many ways, it might be our ruin. Because if they can't figure it out, if they can't breed out insect infestations and make plants undesirable to the next generation after that of pests, then we're really in big trouble.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to African-American food historian Michael W. Twitty, interviewed by our own Jerry Williams in Washington.
You know, I find it's fascinating and very encouraging that the numbers of people participating in food production in this country has really soared, even within the last two or three years. But you have found this line of history from the gardens of enslaved Virginians and Marylanders, and that they really had unique characteristics that they have adapted that was both good agricultural practice and also uniquely reflective of African spirituality mm-hmm. and heritage.
Well, I mean, across the South, from Missouri to Florida, Maryland to Texas, I'm talking about what historians used to call the slave South. There's spread a tradition of, you know, having these gardens. The garden-growing tradition is something that was brought from West and Central Africa. And essentially, the earliest enslaved people were not as tractable as we've been led to believe. In fact, because they were living in frontier conditions, they let it be known to their captors that we can revolt, or we can commit suicide, or we can leave, or we can just not work at any given point. So you have a choice. You can either, you know, compromise with us, or you can face economic financial disaster. We have no way of getting back home, but it doesn't mean that we aren't willing to suffer, to make you suffer. And so, therefore, I think it's forgotten that there was a lot of negotiating going on in those early days of slavery. And one of the most important things was that in West Africa, even among the enslaved class, and I think it's very important to mention that, there was a lot of class stratification in West Africa at that point in time. That's what trade does, you know, making money does that to you. You had enslaved people, male and female, typically that were not in the same ethnic group as you. But unlike American chattel slavery, you could become a part of your slaveholder's family and ethnic group. And they often did. It is rare that people just stayed in the state of being enslaved or being indentured servants. One of the one of the rules, was that you had to give that person or those people a day off to cultivate their own fields. Part of that was practical. It was practical. Why should I put out all the food for them? They should make their own food. But that part was just a sense of ownership and a sense of control. That was brought into American slavery, first in the West Indies and then in North America. I hate it when I read these books and say, the master, God, I hate that word, gave the slaves, I hate that word too, a garden. No, they didn't. Our ancestors said, look, this is how it's going to go down. We're going to have a piece of land. You're going to give it to us. We're going to cultivate our own things the way we like to do it, the way it should look, the way it should be, and we're going to eat. You're going to save some money, and we're going to save some culture. Now, of course, it didn't happen in that kind of slick sort of 21st century way that I just put it in, but pretty much close to it. And these gardens were not linear. They were jungles. They were the forest, you know. They had their own canopies. They had their own understory. They had their own floor. And people mimicked nature in these gardens. This was tens of thousands of years of African know-how went into these gardens. You know, you have to understand that the history of European farming in antiquity, especially for Northern Europeans, did not go back very far. But for these West Africans, we're talking about 5,000 BCE. This is substantial. This is not just throw a seed in the ground. And so you might have gourds and watermelons and squash growing on the floor of that garden, covering it from weeds and, you know, choking the light out so they won't be able to flourish. And by the way, those weeds were really edible plants. And I promise you, given the nutritiousness of some of those weeds, they were easily plucked out and eaten at every opportunity. So they didn't really have a chance. And then, of course, you know, they would grow on the same mounds as other crops, sweet potatoes or corn or something else, you know, sorghum, which we, you know, was brought to the South on a very early date. And, of course, the legumes, the black-eyed peas, other things grew up those stalks. And so you have peanuts between them. So every viable bit of space in this garden would have been used. Sometimes those gardens were a little patched. Sometimes they were as big as 3 to 4 acres in the off lands, you know, undesirable land for other things. It was very colloquial and discretionary. We had ribbons of different colors, shells, blowing in the wind feathers, bits of glass, bottle trees, shell patterns on the ground, charms, power objects, symbols of the ancestors and the deities of West African religions, all called those gardens home. And that was being noted by travelers in the South as late as the Depression, 1930s, that these things were still there, still a part of the scene, that they weren't understood. I wouldn't say misunderstood because no one was trying to understand them. They weren't understood. They were just parts of the culture that kind of like faded off. And so for me, it's really an act of restoration to put those things back into our culture, because they are the savor, the seasoning of what it is meant to be Black in America. To have adopted elements from so many different cultures and blended them together for our own purposes, and to give our lives meaning beyond just the predicament of being of color in a culture, in a country that was not made for us, but it certainly was made by us. So that aesthetic, those colors, those shells, those spiritual matters, the gourd. I'll tell you about the gourd hanging up for one example. You know, you'd hang up a gourd in your garden. Now, sometimes the gourd would double as the birdhouse for purple martins, which chase off other things and eat pests out of your garden. There you go, your organic pest control. But also, gourds were seen as houses for spirits. And so this was your genie in a bottle. And I call this African-American feng shui. Because you're inviting the good spirits into your garden. So you set up your house here. Or you're saying to the bad spirits, hey, come here. It was like a mousetrap. And they have to stay in that gourd and do what you say. You know, in Haiti, they call that point, a spirit, a bad spirit that you tell what to do and control. And for some people, that might seem a little bit esoteric or mystical or magical or unacceptable or idolatrous. But for me, it is that kind of folklore that makes us us. And I don't want to see it die.
That was Radio EcoShock's correspondent Jerry Williams with Michael Twitty, the specialist in African and African-American food. He knows it from seed to the dinner table. Michael's histories of African-American foodways have been published all over the place, including his own recipes from beans to pork to Michael Twitty's heirloom cowhorn okra soup. Find his website at michaelwilliamtwitty.com and in my blog at ecoshock.info. My thanks to Jerry Williams for knowing the right people and the right questions. This is a bit from the artist Memphis Gold. He was born in Tennessee but now lives in Washington, D.C.
Well, Mississippi, flatland, as far as you can see, walking on the rock road down to the levee. I know that I saw her, fine as she can be. She's a country girl, she's the one for me. Looking back on time and how she treated me, Mississippi, flatland, as far as I can see, Mississippi, flatland. I think I will go north. Reason why I'm going to see my baby there. Mississippi flatland, keep me if you dare. Mississippi flatland, Mississippi flatland.